With Thanksgiving nearly upon us, cooks are making their shopping lists, checking them twice, and perhaps looking for ideas in carefully saved November issues of Gourmet magazine. This month's issue is its last. Condé Nast has pulled the plug on the nearly 70-year-old publication, but NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg found Gourmet's erstwhile editor, Ruth Reichel, alive and, well, thinking of cranberries.
Just for starters, Ruth, condolences. There are so many people that mourning the loss of Gourmet magazine.
And I am among them.
Yes, I'm sure you are. Well, I know you lost that job. Last month, you launched a new public television show, Gourmet's Adventures with Ruth. But I know that public broadcasting doesn't pay all that well. So although we never pay for interviews here at NPR, I would like to offer you $5 from my wallet, if you would help me tell listeners about Mama Stamberg's cranberry relish this year.
I would be happy to do that, and I will frame your $5.
Well, you may need it sometime, so good. Thank you. This, you know, is the recipe that sounds terrible but tastes terrific. We emailed you a copy of it in New York. You got it in front of you?
I do, but I have to tell you, you didn't have to email it to me because I already had it from many years back.
That's wonderful. Well, okay, go ahead.
2 cups whole raw cranberries washed.
Good.
1 small onion. What is your idea of a small onion?
Oh, you know, what would that be? Like 3 inches in diameter, maybe? Is that small? Yeah.
Because onions have gotten very big these days.
I know, yeah. No, this one, 3 inches.
And would you prefer one of the sweet, no-tear onions that are now available everywhere or an ordinary old onion?
Ordinary old one. I think a tear or two can't hurt.
But tears on Thanksgiving, absolutely. 3/4 cup sour cream, 1/2 cup sugar, 2 tablespoons of horseradish from a jar. Red is a bit milder than white.
Now, you see, this is where it sounds terrible and tastes terrific. Everybody, when you get to the horseradish, people go, ew.
Well, I think most people are sort of, ew, at the sour cream.
That too, and the onion doesn't help that much either. Nonetheless, why don't you tell us what to do next?
Grind the raw berries and onion together. Add everything else and mix.
Mm-hmm.
Put in a plastic container and freeze. So how far ahead of time do you usually do this?
I do it the night before so that it sits in the freezer overnight.
Okay. But you could do it earlier than that, right?
Oh, sure.
You could do it a week. Yeah.
Absolutely. And by the way, it keeps for a long time afterward, too, so you could have it really forever.
I don't know that you want to say forever.
Right. Anyway, so there it sits in the freezer Thanksgiving morning. Can you continue, please?
I can. You move it from the freezer to the refrigerator compartment to thaw. And what you say here is it should still have some little icy slivers left.
Yeah, because that's sort of, it's so unexpected. I mean, the whole thing is unexpected, but the little icy slivers, if you're lucky, that's nice too. Because, you know, it cuts through all that gravy taste of Thanksgiving. It's something sharp and kind of unexpected.
And a little coldness in all the heat of Thanksgiving is really nice.
Right.
The relish will be thick, creamy, and shocking pink. And here you add, Pepto-Bismol pink.
I feel one must tell the truth. That is the color.
And it is shocking, I have to say, on a Thanksgiving table. Having had this on my Thanksgiving table many times.
Oh, my goodness.
It is really shocking. It's a color that doesn't look like it belongs on your Thanksgiving table.
Exactly. But it tastes so good, and it's got that sort of little punch, and it makes about a pint and a half. What do you think, Ruth Reichel? Any suggestions for improving this thing?
Oh, no, it's perfect just as it is.
And tell me this. If there still were a gourmet magazine, would you publish this recipe for the next Thanksgiving?
Oh, absolutely.
Woohoo!
A good reason to bring the magazine back.
Thank you so much, and a very happy Thanksgiving to you.
And to you.
Ruth Reichel, food lover, food editor, author, and star of the new public TV series Gourmet's Adventures with Ruth. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Oh, yes, a little early Thanksgiving greeting, and that recipe for Mama Stamberg's cranberry relish is at npr.org.
So to recap here, Gourmet magazine gone, cranberry relish still with us. This week, Costco, the nation's largest wholesale shopping club, took Coca-Cola products off its shelves. The two companies are in a fight over prices. Susanna Capelluto of Georgia Public Broadcasting has more.
This week, Costco posted signs in its soft drink aisles that said, "At present, we are not carrying Coke products because we cannot provide the value our customers deserve." Tim Rose with Costco justified the public posting, even as negotiations continued.
"We are having some pricing disputes with Coke and have removed Coke products from sale at Costco."
"I guess they're looking out for us."
Outside a Costco in Coke's hometown of Atlanta, Dave Danis loads early Christmas presents for his two daughters into his Jeep. He's a regular here and says while he enjoys Coke, it's not all he drinks.
"I'll drink Pepsi. I mean, I go to Taco Bell and they don't serve Coke. So I'll either get Pepsi or Dr. Pepper."
Things are different for Michelle Kelly, who rolls a shopping cart to her car just a few spots away. She says she buys Coke products regularly at Costco.
"My husband drinks it daily, at least 3 to 4 cans a day of Sprite."
This is not the first time Costco stopped selling a product over money. Jerry Carmouche is with the trade publication Beverage Business Insights. He says Costco temporarily pulled Capri Sun earlier this year after Kraft Foods reduced the amount of juice per pouch and apparently raised prices. And that, Camouche says, shows that mega stores are getting bolder.
"We're really talking, you know, a power struggle between retailers who are increasingly powerful as the retail segment consolidates and marketers. So, you know, Costco kind of has a reputation for throwing its weight around."
But Coke is no lightweight either. Its products have what analysts call close to 100% penetration. That means almost every U.S. household buys some kind of Coke product. So Coke knows that retailers need its soft drinks. John Sisher with Beverage Digest says that's why this dispute is remarkable.
"Usually these kinds of negotiations between a Coke and Pepsi and a Costco or a Walmart or a Sam's Club, play out in private. What was unusual was the public nature of this."
Coke is not commenting on this dispute or its pricing structure. Analyst Jerry Camouche says the beverage giant's goal in mega retail negotiations is to protect its bottlers.
"And Coca-Cola has to be very careful not to offer Costco such good deals that the small retailers who might otherwise go to the local Coke bottler finds himself or herself compelled to go to Costco to buy their product instead."
Squabbles between large retailers and suppliers could become more common. In this economy, consumers are looking for the best bargains, and retailers want to offer them. All this while product marketers are not seeing their costs go down. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capelluto in Atlanta.
And now for some headlines that could only come from The Onion.
Obama's home teleprompter malfunctions during family dinner.
NASCAR coach reveals winning strategy, drive fast.
Nation's gentrified neighborhoods threatened by aristocratization.
Postmaster General says letter carrier surge is working.
And now the satirical newspaper that modestly calls itself America's finest news source is out with a new book.
And two of the Onion editors joined us from New York, Joe Randazzo and Joe Garden. Welcome.
It's good to be here, Renee.
Yes, thank you.
There are several books of the Onion, right? But this is
Yes. Our
front pages. And those front pages really it hinges on the headline.
Absolutely. As a lot of people who have cornered us at parties have informed us, well, I only read the headlines anyway. We're pandering to the lowest common denominator with this with this one.
And on the other end of the spectrum, I think it's a book for the diehard fans who would never get to see a lot of these older covers as well. So we've got the erudite obsessive people and then the dumb people.
Right.
I think it would be fair to say one of the classic headlines was "New Starbucks opens in restroom of existing Starbucks." I'm
right.
Sorry, I can't even read it without laughing. Do you write the headlines first?
Yeah, everything really extends from the headline. You've got to be able to have a joke that gets its point across, but it all starts with 500 to 800 headlines that we get every week, and then we kind of call those down and pick out the best of the best.
And then where do the headlines come from? That is your
desperate. The headlines come from long periods of desperation, boredom, and fleeting panic that we have to get our assignment done in time for the Monday meeting.
Right. There's also angry, bitter observations of other people in life who you think have it better than you. There's things that annoy you. And then a lot of sitting around watching TV.
We live very rich lives.
We're all perfectly satisfied.
And you wonder if, you know, everything is sort of fodder, or if you, when you see a headline like guests forced to pretend wedding a good thing. And I'm thinking, who was at the wedding? And that's all they could think.
I've even talked to writers who've told me that it's an obsession that nearly everything that they see, think, or do gets instantly kind of reframed into this headline. So I think it is. It runs the gamut from big national absurdist events to, you know, your roommate eating the rest of your Hot Pockets or something.
Yes. It does have this huge swing. And there's ones in the middle, like gay couple to add exciting big city feel to small town. It is sort of a little bit about your roommate or the guy down the street, but it's also sort of about big issues.
It's also sort of about some of us grew up in small towns. I grew up in a town of 5,000 in rural Wisconsin, and we channel that small town newspaper voice. And sometimes it is sort of like couching bigger issues in like a very sort of banal way.
Well, one headline that, you know, people talk about, and I'm actually curious, you know, how it came about. Several headlines that you had in The Onion that came out after September 11th.
Right. There's a terrorist surprise to find cells in hell. That was always that was actually one that I was against because I thought it was just too pandering. But it turned out to be a very cathartic one that people liked a lot.
But that issue did kind of run the gamut of hugging up 10,000%.
Sure, and not knowing what else to do, Woman Bakes American Flag Cake, which is a personal favorite.
God clarifies no killing rule.
Angrily clarifies. Sorry.
And I mean, U.S. vows to defeat whoever it is we're at war with.
Sure.
But I'm wondering, do you have limits to your taste or your willingness to do tasteless things?
No, there's no topic that ever has come up that has been, oh, no, we can't touch that topic. But we are just as conscious of making sure that if we do try to tackle a topic that is a little more sensitive, that we're targeting the right people or the right entity, and that we're not just making jokes about horrible things with no context or no point or no heart.
You know, when you talk about the right side, the right side suggests some sort of political position or even a moral position. And what does that mean?
It's more about common sense to us,
right?
Or kind of pointing out hypocrisy or stupidity. And of course, we get to do it, you know, unanimously. So we don't have to share any of our own hypocrisies or stupidities with the world. But I don't think that anybody ever has a political axe to grind on the staff. I would not say that we are a group of Republicans, but I don't think that we're a group of really left-wing liberals either. You know, if we see something that you can look at and say, well, that's kind of stupid. They're acting kind of stupidly here. We should make a joke about that.
Well, in this last presidential election, you were pretty equal opportunity and found humor actually at that point when people were a little leery of trying to make jokes about Barack Obama.
Are you talking about a black man given the nation's worst job? was worst is paraphrasing, yeah. I believe. And then one of the other smaller stories was nation finally shitty enough to make social progress, which is another really good one. Of course, we also had an issue prepared in case John McCain won, which had nation elects first ever 44th white president and a maverick put in charge of world's largest nuclear arsenal. So that's actually in the book.
You do have one headline that says, factual error found on internet. error, singular, just to make sure people know. But I've heard that with the internet, some people see your fake stories and actually think they're real.
That happens a lot. And fortunately, if you present something in a very real fashion, some people will just sort of accept it at face value. When you have a story like Congress threatens to relocate unless a new Capitol building is built, which would, you know,
retractable dome
for daylight legislation and so on. And that was actually picked up by a Chinese newspaper and run. They translated it and ran it as actual fact, including the graphic that our graphics guys worked so hard on.
Now, that actually I could see you being pretty gleeful about. I mean, you just almost can't blame the Chinese. It's a little off, but they're another culture.
This is true.
You know, they positioned it as, you see the debaucherous nature of even the American leaders, you know. And then when they finally learned that it was a satirical newspaper. I think they printed a response that was like, so you see, in America, they have newspapers that make money off of lies.
Right.
So it was quite an honor, actually.
Joe Randazzo and Joe Garden are editors at The Onion. They are two of the many editors of the new book, Our Front Pages, 21 Years of Greatness, Virtue, and Moral Rectitude from America's Finest News Source. Thank you both very much.
Oh, were we recording that whole time?
I thought this was a pre-interview.
And we have more headlines at npr.org, including a few at our expense. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have an update this morning on a news story that's thousands of years old. It's the extinction of giant animals that once roamed the Earth. Scientists do not know what killed off woolly mammoths and other animals after the last ice age. Maybe the climate changed. Maybe a comet struck the Earth. Maybe humans hunted them down. Now, a study out today in Science magazine examines some evidence the animals left behind. Here's NPR's Richard Harris.
After the end of the last ice age, North America was covered with large animals even more diverse than we see in Africa today.
We had, you know, the iconic mammoths and mastodons, but also beaver the size of black bear, you know, giant ground sloths. There were camels and horses in North America, which is often a surprise to many people. And then, of course, their predators, right, like the American lion, the short-faced bear, the dire wolves, etc.
Jacqueline Gill is getting her PhD at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she's fascinated by how we came to have such diverse wildlife and why those animals are all gone today.
By about 11,000 years ago, we lose half of the animals in North America larger than the size of a German shepherd, and that's a pretty big ecological event.
There aren't enough bones left to figure out in detail when exactly they all went extinct, but Gill and her colleagues hit upon a nifty method to track the abundance of grazing animals. The scientists study, of all things, a certain species of fungus. Spores of the fungus end up in lake sediments that date back some 15,000 years.
So the spores from this fungus are preserved in the lake, and this fungus only grows on animal dung.
When there were lots of large animals, there was lots of dung. When the animals went away, so did the dung and the fungus that lived on those droppings. So, by studying the amount of this fungus in various layers of lake sediment, Gill and her group have pieced together a timetable that helps resolve how and when these animals died out. One of the long-held ideas had been that a climate shift caused a change in vegetation, and the new plant matter was no good for these grazing animals, so they starved. But no, Gill and company have disproved that by putting a date on the animal's decline. It was way back, more than 14,000 years ago.
And this happens before this, some of the widespread vegetation change that we see in the areas that we studied, which suggests to us that habitat loss is actually not a cause of the declines, but possibly a consequence.
That is, the vegetation might have changed after the browsing animals disappeared and stopped munching on it. The new dates also help eliminate other ideas that have been argued over the years. John Alroy at the University of California, Santa Barbara, says it's clear that the extinctions couldn't have been caused by a cold snap called the Younger Dryas.
These data show that the extinction happened well before that time. And there's also been a recent paper arguing that the extinction might have been caused by the impact of a comet. And that impact appears to have happened much, much later than the decline, at least at this location.
So what does that leave? Well, human beings were moving into North America at that time. So Alroy says this is more evidence that hunters played a key role in driving those large animals to extinction.
And now really the question is exactly what did humans do to cause this large extinction?
Jacqueline Gill at Madison is interested in that question too, because she notes human beings are now forcing another mass extinction as we reshape habitat around the world. Richard Harris, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. For the second time in a week, women are being advised to reconsider the way they get tested for cancer.
Days ago, a panel of experts said women could wait before getting regular mammograms. That set off a widespread debate.
Now the recommendations are changing for the test for cervical cancer. Experts say there is no need for the test before age 21, and older women do not need the test as often. NPR's Brenda Wilson explains.
The old recommendation from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or ACOG, was that pap smears should start 3 years after a girl begins having sex, or at least by age 21. But because cervical cancer is slow-growing, ACOG says such early tests aren't needed. Not only that, they only have to be done every 2 years until she's 30.
The incidence of invasive cancer of the cervix in teenagers is exceptionally low. This is a cancer of women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s.
That's Dr. Alan Waxman. He wrote the new guidelines for ACOG's Gynecology Practice Committee. He says scientists now know that many young women become infected with the human papillomavirus, or HPV, that causes cervical cancer. That can cause abnormal pap smears, even though most of the time it clears up on its own. And so subjecting a young girl to a frightening test is unnecessary.
She's very, very sensitive to her body image. She goes and gets her first pap test. It comes back abnormal. Now she's confronted with the question of, do I have cancer in my reproductive organs? She has to go through additional tests, which, again, are intrusive, may be uncomfortable.
The committee wanted to avoid subjecting women to treatments that might require surgery or procedures that pose a risk to a young woman's reproductive health.
An increasing number of studies have come out showing that women who have had these treatments have an increased risk of premature births if they get pregnant subsequently. Now, most women who get treated don't have prematurity, but when you think about treatment in teenagers, they've got their whole reproductive life ahead of them.
When a woman turns 30, the committee recommends that if a woman has 3 normal tests, the screenings can then be done every 3 years. Dr. David Soper, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Medical College of South Carolina, says the committee started working on these recommendations in 2007.
The recommendations really are just catching up with what the science is. And that is that you do not improve cancer detection by doing annual smears in women at the various age groups. So I don't think there's any danger in this new guidance.
The greatest danger, it turns out, is to women who don't ever get pap smears or haven't had one in 5 years. They make up more than half of the 11,000 women who die from the disease in the United States. There's unlikely to be very much objection to the new guidelines in the medical community. The American Cancer Society is about to undergo a similar review, according to its deputy medical officer, Lynn Lichtenfeld, who says there isn't the same intense disagreement over pap smears as there is surrounding the issue of mammograms.
Within the cervical cancer community, experts have been working together, have pretty much had a consensus about what to do. And I think that since that's good news because it gives a fairly straightforward message to women.
There are some women who do need more frequent pap smears. Women who are infected with HIV, who have a suppressed immune system, or who have had a previous abnormal pap smear should continue to be screened every year for cervical cancer. And ACOG recommends that women should still visit the gynecologist annually, even if they're not going to get a pap smear. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
The national unemployment rate is now at 10.2%, but it's especially concentrated in industries dominated by men, like construction and manufacturing, which is why sometimes people are calling this the he-cession, and it's hit African-American men especially hard. In one of our kitchen table conversations on the nation's economy, NPR's Cheryl Corley has this profile of one man looking for work.
When 53-year-old Randolph Smith is working, he manages logistics, inventory, and supplies for large companies. He's been trying to find that type of work since he was laid off a year ago, but so far he's had no success. Racquetball, says Smith, has been a lifesaver.
What's up, home team?
And he meets friends at a local health club about 3 or 4 times a week.
Just to be able to, you know, come somewhere that's affordable for me, not far from home, and to be around some good friends where there's camaraderie and to exercise and just to get the stress off my life.
It's a stress that hundreds of thousands of black men face. While the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts the latest unemployment rates for whites and Latinos at 9.5% and 13.1% respectively, the jobless rate for African Americans is nearly 16%. For African American men who lead the country's jobless surge, it's 17.1%. So these days, Randolph Smith's main focus is trying to land a job.
Well, this is our office.
where my wife and I spend a lot of time. I spend 8 hours at least a day here.
Smith lives in Richland Park, a solidly middle-class suburb about 30 miles southwest of Chicago. He and his wife, Sabrina, raised their now adult son here. They've converted a bedroom into a home office, two desks, two computers, a file cabinet with plenty of Post-it notes attached. Smith's wife is an administrative assistant at a local hospital and is studying to be a nurse. And this office is where Smith conducts his job search.
Going through a lot of the search agents that have brought information or leads to me, following up with phone calls, just making any and all new connections that I can.
The Smiths cut back on vacations and they don't go out much. And like any good inventory manager, Smith says he uses a spreadsheet for their grocery shopping.
We know how to stretch a meal out. We know how to eat beans and rice and, you know, make that last for a couple of days and spaghetti. And, you know, so we're doing all the right things I think we need to do to keep things going and keep our costs down.
When Caterpillar Incorporated started shedding jobs last year, Smith, the contract employee, was let go. It was not an unfamiliar situation. Throughout his career, just about every business Smith has worked for has closed, relocated, or downsized. Typically, he's found another job quickly. Not so this time.
I think I'm marketable, and usually would be no problem finding some work with a temp agency, enough that would suffice. You know, since the beginning of the year, it's been dry.
Smith says they get by on his unemployment, his wife's part-time salary, and savings.
All right, we got a pop quiz.
About 30 people are sitting at classroom desks during a workforce readiness class run by the Chicago Urban League. This class used to be one of Smith's destinations.
I wanted to make sure that I was as polished as possible. And, you know, I just really had to get real with myself and say that, you know, I need some help here.
Herman Brewer, the acting CEO of Chicago's Urban League, says black men seeking work have long faced at least one of these factors: limited schooling, incarceration, or discrimination. And Brewer says with lucrative manufacturing jobs disappearing, any rise in unemployment is particularly tough on black men.
Because many have had to overcome so much just to get where they were in a particular job.
And many African-American men, says Brewer, will personalize their job loss and withdraw socially. Randolph Smith admits some of his relationships have changed.
I've had friends that have reached out and said, hey, man, come on, I'll, you know, pay for a round of golf for you. But not that it's pride, but, you know, I just want to get through this myself.
What sustains him, says Smith, is his faith. He goes to church regularly. Once a week, he tutors children. And then, of course, there's the racquetball. Smith says despite dismal job prospects, he's hopeful he'll soon leave the ever-increasing ranks of African-American males who are unemployed. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.